for his presidential library, to say nothing of their shared viewpoints on the status of women. When Moore endorsed Democrat Wesley Clark for president, Clark proudly posted the endorsement on his website and invited Moore to speak at his fundraisers. And, of course, Moore sat with Jimmy Carter at the Democratic National Convention, which drew more than a few stares, mostly from people wondering when the luxury box would collapse. Tom Daschle and Terry McAuliffe attended the Washington, D.C. premiere of Fahrenheit 9/11, when Daschle was still Senate Minority Leader and McAuliffe was chairman of the DNC. David Boies, former election-stealing lawyer for sore loser Al Gore, was co-host of the event. Moore's movie was being promoted by a veritable who's who of Democrat flacks, including Howard Wolfson, Hillary's former press secretary, Michael Feldman, former advisor to Al Gore's 2000 presidential race, and Mark Fabiani and Chris Lehane, former spokesman for both Bill Clinton and Al Gore. Attending the advance screening of the movie in Manhattan were former UN ambassador and Democrat Richard Holbrooke, former Clinton advisor Democrat Vernon Jordan, former Democratic presidential candidate Al Sharpton, Democrat Al Franken, and devoted Clinton supporter Democrat Martha Stewart, representing convicted felons, a key segment of the Democratic vote. It was like a P. Diddy birthday party in the Hamptons, but with less gunplay. If the Democrats don't want Republicans associating their good names with Michael Moore, perhaps they should stop associating with Michael Moore. Or does revealing the Democrats' association with Michael Moore violate some criminal law I'm unaware of? Perhaps liberals will claim Moore is a covert agent with the CIA, assuming a big, sweaty behemoth like Michael Moore could actually be concealed, and McClellan has outed him. Or does the fact that Murtha fought in Vietnam prohibit comment on anything he says? Does he have absolute moral authority too? How about simply repeating what Democrats say? Can we do that? At the end of 2005, the Republican National Committee ran a web ad showing various Democrats sharing their insights about the war in Iraq with a white flag waving between each video clip. Howard Dean, Democratic National Committee Chairman. The idea that we're going to win the war is an idea that, unfortunately, is just plain wrong. White flag waving. Senator Barbara Boxer, Democrat, California. There's no specific time frame, but I would say the withdrawal has to start now, right after the elections, December 15th. White flag waving. Senator John Kerry, Democrat, Massachusetts. There is no reason, Bob, that young American soldiers need to be going into the homes of Iraqis in the dead of night, terrorizing kids and children, you know, women. At the end of the commercial, the camera panned back to show a soldier watching the clips and ends with the message, "Our soldiers are watching, and our enemies are too." What are they going to accuse us of now? Taking their comments in context? Guess who the Democrats sent out to attack the RNC ad? We're almost at the end of the chapter, so you shouldn't have to read ahead. Was it NATO Paris Office Kennedy? Was it Bad Back Dean? Dean avoided Vietnam by producing a note from his doctor and a fake limp at the Army recruiting office before repairing to Aspen for months of skiing. No, none of these. It was one of the Democrats' surprise military war heroes. Having already used up the war service of Cleland, Kerry, and Murtha, this time it was Senator Daniel Inouye, World War II Medal of Honor winner. Inouye denounced the RNC ad, saying, "As a veteran of World War II, I know what it's like to fight a war and put your life on the line every day. I also know what it takes to win a war, and I know that politics and an attack machine like the president's plays no part in it. Remember, the alleged attack machine did nothing but show clips of Democrats talking about the war. And two of the Democrats weren't veterans or widows, so even under the Cleland rule, we're allowed to criticize them. The machismo of liberals about real war reached hysterical proportions in a Nicholas Kristof New York Times column decrying Bill O'Reilly's Fox News stories about liberals' war on Christmas by lecturing O'Reilly on real war. Look, I put up a Christmas tree rather than a holiday tree, and I'm sure Mr. O'Reilly is right that political correctness leads to absurd contortions this time of year. But when you've seen what real war does, you don't lightly use the word to describe disagreements about Christmas greetings. And does it really make sense to offer 58 segments on political correctness and zero on genocide? Kristof knows real war, not because he's fought, mind you, but because he's covered wars as a scribbler. So no more chatter about liberals' war on Christmas, Fox News. Perhaps Kristof should raise the importance of real war with his colleague Frank Rich, who had a column on the gay cowboy movie Brokeback Mountain just above Kristof's column that day. Is real war more important than a review of a movie about gay cowboys? Rich's column was one of four articles in the Times that day on Brokeback Mountain, the 10th in the Times that week, and Rich's 10th gay-themed column for the year, out of 47 columns in all. Liberals shape the debate with loud chanting, monopolize your brain through the TV, and then pull cheap parlor tricks to prevent any opposing arguments from being heard. Her husband died. Her son died. His kid almost died, partly as a result of candidate Al's own negligence. His wife works at the CIA. He's a war hero. He covered a war in Darfur for the New York Times. Stop the hate. They yell in unison, frightening people with their ferocity, and then announce that disagreement will not be permitted. What crackpot argument can't be immunized by the left's invocation of infallibility based on personal experience? Today, a Democrat called for the institution of communism in America, confiscation of all private property, forcible agricultural collectivization, imprisonment of intellectuals, and seizure of all handguns, moments before her entire family was wiped out in a tornado. Responses? Perhaps the Democrats could find an orphaned child whose parents were brutally hacksawed to death to put forth their tax plan. If these Democrat human shields have a point worth making, how about allowing it to be made by someone we're allowed to respond to? Chapter 6. The Liberal Priesthood. Spare the rod, spoil the teacher. The only group in society that must be spoken of in reverential terms at all times, no matter what, is public school teachers. Attack the Boy Scouts, boycott Mel Gibson, put Christ in a jar of urine, but don't dare say anything bad about teachers. Unless you want it noted on your permanent record. We are simultaneously supposed to gasp in awe at teachers' raw dedication and be forced to listen to their incessant caterwauling about how they don't make enough money. Well, which is it? Are they dedicated to teaching, or are they in it for the money? After all the carping about how little teachers are paid, if someone enters the teaching profession for the big bucks, aren't they too stupid to be teaching our kids? Public school teachers are the new priesthood, while traditional religion is ridiculed and maligned. As portrayed in the national pulpit of Hollywood, leaders of God-based religions are invariably lying scum. Not since Alfred Hitchcock's I Confess, 1953, has Hollywood conceived of a priest or minister who was not a Nazi sympathizer, sexual predator, or some other breed of moral viper. Priests and ministers are smarmy, humorless hypocrites in movies like The People vs. Larry Flint, but the pornographer comes off favorably, Judgment, Child Molesting Priest, and The Runner Stumbles, Dick Van Dyke as a hypocritical priest who impregnates a nun. In Sister Act, Whoopi Goldberg is a Reno lounge singer on the lam who shakes up the stodgy convent with her fun, upbeat attitude. The late, briefly aired, and little-missed TV show The Book of Daniel was about a drug-addicted Episcopal priest, Daniel, who had an alcoholic wife, a drug-dealing daughter, one gay son, and another son who was having sex with the bishop's daughter. Daniel's lesbian secretary was having sex with his sister-in-law. In other words, it was a typical Hollywood family drama. By contrast, the moment a teacher walks onto the screen, you know who the hero is going to be. Teachers are Robin Williams in Dead Poets Society, Michelle Pfeiffer in Dangerous Minds, John Voight in Conrack, Richard Dreyfuss in Mr. Holland's Opus, Kevin Kline in The Emperor's Club, Morgan Freeman in Lean on Me, and Julia Roberts in Mona Lisa Smile. Among the Teacher as Saint movies are Goodbye, Mr. Chips, three versions, The Blackboard Jungle, Stand and Deliver, and on and on and on. There are only two possible plots in movies about teachers. Either inspirational teachers bring their passion and dedication to inner-city schools, or inspirational teachers bring their passion and dedication to bored suburban kids. In real life, these taxpayer-supported parasites are inculcating students in the precepts of the Socialist Party of America, as understood by retarded people. In early 2006, Sean Allen, a student at Overland High School in Colorado, taped his 10th grade world geography teacher, Jay Benish, ranting incoherently about Bush for 20 minutes during class. After a brief detour, during which Benish condemned the capitalist system, he proceeded briskly to his main point. George W. Bush is like Hitler. Anyone who uses this adolescent cliché should not be in the 10th grade, much less teaching it. But Benish thought he was Socrates, telling his students, "What I am trying to get you to do is think more in depth." How about this? Al Gore is like Hitler. Nancy Pelosi is like Hitler. Kanye West is like Hitler. Jay Benish is like Hitler. And that guy on the Subway sandwich shop TV commercials who lost all the weight? I'm thinking Hitler. Are you cogitating deep thoughts? Although surely smarter than Benish, not all American teenagers are bright enough to withstand the constant propaganda from authority figures who are grading them. Part of Benish's Socratic dialogue that day included this exchange. Benish: "Who is probably the single most violent nation on planet Earth?" Unidentified student apple polisher: "We are." Benish: "The United States of America." After Benish was placed on a short, paid administrative leave, about 150 students, who can't place Spain on a map, walked out of the school to protest his suspension. The new clergy not only teach children clever repartee, such as "Bush is like Hitler," but they use their positions as taxpayer-supported wards of the state to demote the old religion, treating prayer, Bibles, and Christmas songs like hate crimes. At the Coral Street Elementary School in State College, Pennsylvania, children were led in a chant of Celebrate Kwanzaa, while Christmas carols were stripped of all religious content. At Pattison Elementary School in Katy, Texas, Christmas songs were banned, but students were threatened with grade reductions for refusing to sing songs celebrating other religious faiths. A school district in California prohibits teachers from mentioning Christmas or wearing Christmas jewelry. A New Jersey teacher was forced by an ACLU suit to abandon plans to take children to see the Broadway version of A Christmas Carol. In Panama City, Florida, the school principal changed the name of a Bible study group from Fellowship of Christian Students to Fellowship of Concerned Students, and for good measure prohibited the club from advertising. A school administrator in Dallas, Texas, was reprimanded for using her email to forward copies of President Bush's National Day of Prayer proclamation. Though the school district had no problem with employees using email to send jokes, chain emails, and secular messages of encouragement. The worst scandal to hit the real churches in 20 years is the priest-child molestation scandal, which, by the way, pales in comparison to the teacher-child molestation problem. If only the depraved priests had had teachers' unions defending them, they'd still be running amok. All we'd ever hear about is how priests are hard-working, underpaid, and laboring under ghastly parishioner-priest ratios. The hero in every third Hollywood film would be a priest, and letters to the editor pages would be bristling with indignant letters complaining about how poorly priests are paid. Bumper stickers would suddenly appear saying, "Someday we'll have enough money for the Lord's house, and the Air Force will hold bake sales to pay for its bombers." Most important, every school-age child in America would be required to attend Catholic Church for 6 hours a day, all subsidized by the taxpayer. I'm sure there are a lot of wonderful, caring public school teachers out there, but there are also a lot of wonderful, caring Catholic priests. That doesn't stop people from noticing when there's a rash of bad ones. We'd all die without energy companies, but no liberal lips quiver when Enron comes under attack. Why are educators in government schools the only people on earth who must universally be spoken of in hushed tones of religious worship? As it happens, public schools rival Enron when it comes to financial scandals and have more sex scandals per year than Catholic priests, 30 times more. But don't mention it, or you'll be accused of hating teachers. At least the public schools perform such a great service. According to David Salisbury, director of the Center for Educational Freedom at the Cato Institute, throughout the 20th century, the scores of preschool-age children on IQ and kindergarten readiness tests have climbed steadily upward. It's not until they move up through grade school and on to high school that their performance declines. The international comparisons are breathtaking. American students excel on international tests in fourth grade, the earliest grade for which international comparisons are available. In fourth grade, after the public schools have had only a few years to do their damage, American students far outperform other countries in reading, math, and science. Fourth graders score in the 92nd percentile in science, the 70th percentile in reading, and the 58th percentile in math. They beat 26 of 35 countries in reading literacy, including Germany, France, and Italy. The main educational difference between American children and Western European children at that age is that most American children have not been subjected to preschool, whereas almost all European children have. But as American children spend more time in school, their scores decline. By the eighth grade, Americans are merely average in international tests. By the 12th grade, having received all the benefits of an American education, they are near the bottom. Math scores plummet from the 58th percentile in 4th grade to the 14th percentile in 12th grade. Most stunningly, in 4th grade, Americans are in the 92nd percentile in science literacy, bested only by students in South Korea and Japan. 8 years later, American 12th graders' science scores have fallen to the 29th percentile. For those of you who learned math in the U.S. public schools, going from 92nd to the 29th means it went down. The only countries American 12th graders beat in science were Lithuania, Cyprus, and South Africa. If the U.S. Olympic gymnastics team could beat only Lithuania, Cyprus, and South Africa, there would be congressional investigations. Question: is student achievement inversely proportional to time spent in U.S. public schools, or is there a correlation between poor student achievement and time spent in U.S. public schools? Discuss. So that's how schools are doing at their primary mission. But liberals scream bloody murder and accuse you of attacking teachers whenever anyone mentions any problems with the public schools, no matter how meekly, unless problems means only not paying teachers enough. Through their girly guilt-mongering, Democrats have turned public school teachers, or as I call them, disinformational facilitators, into religious icons. It's a good gig, especially if you don't even have to teach. At private schools, 80% of the personnel are teachers. By contrast, at public schools, only about 50% of the personnel are actual teachers. Most of the rest are cogs in the endless layers of machinery of the education bureaucracy. This would be like having 26 full-time coaches for a 26-man baseball team. It's very important for the Democrats to control the public schools. John Dewey, the founder of public education in America, said, "You can't make socialists out of individualists. Children who know how to think for themselves spoil the harmony of the collective society which is coming, where everyone is interdependent. You also can't make socialists out of people who can read, which is probably why Democrats think the public schools have nearly achieved Aristotelian perfection. For Lenin, it was, give me your four-year-olds, and in a generation I will build a socialist state. For Hitler, it was, let me control the textbooks, and I will control the state. For the Democrats, it's, let us control the schools, and in a generation, no one will be able to read." Unfazed by international comparisons showing that American children fall behind with each additional year of school, Democrats want to get our students started falling behind even sooner. In his acceptance speech at the Democratic National Convention, John Kerry proposed investing in Head Start, Early Start, Smart Start, Jump Start, Kick Start, and got a standing ovation. He mentioned the military, and you could hear crickets in the convention hall. Al Gore's 2000 Democratic platform included federal preschool for every child in America. Sandra Feldman of the American Federation of Teachers says America can't afford not to adopt a preschool program like the French, whom our fourth graders crush in international comparisons, by the way. Remember how factories in the old Soviet Union stayed open year after year, even though half the products they turned out were defective? U.S. public schools have become like that, which is why Democrats feel so much at home in the education business. Democrats like to say, sure, Republicans are all for fetuses, But once the child is born, do they care? Their yardstick for caring is, where do you stand on creating jobs for public school teachers? The rule used to be that you could be anti-abortion provided you supported creating more welfare bureaucrats. Los Angeles Times columnist Robert Scheer began a 1995 column with, "Love the fetus, damn the child," and then went on a jeremiad against pro-life, his quotes, Senators Bob Dole and Phil Graham for putting together a welfare reform bill that will make abortion a compelling choice for poor women. Scheer referred to this monstrosity as Dole's bill. Once Dole's bill turned out to be a smashing success, it was renamed Clinton's Welfare Reform Bill, or, for short, President Clinton's crowning achievement. So now the new rule is, in order to be the right kind of pro-lifer, you don't have to support massive increases in spending on welfare programs. You have to support massive increases in spending on public school teachers. When he was running for president in 2004, Al Sharpton said, "Republicans love the fetus, and they cut the funds from the baby. I don't understand this jaded love for children where you cut daycare, cut child care, cut anything, Head Start, but yet you want to protect the fetus coming into the world." For liberals, a human life begins at the precise moment the person starts filling out his first application for a government job. Howard Dean says Democrats should not turn their backs on pro-life people, but only if they are the right kind of pro-life person, by which he means supportive of every possible teachers' union giveaway. Whenever the Democrats talk about increasing spending on the children, what they mean is sending more dollars to useless government bureaucrats, even if they never encounter a child on the job. Until no one in America earns more than a kindergarten teacher, the nation does not value human life. The only work Senator Chris Dodd has ever done in 25 years in the Senate is to try to nationalize kindergarten and pre-kindergarten child care. It's somehow cruel and unfair not to federalize all education workers in America. And there are a lot of them. Teachers, substitute teachers, assistant teachers, substitute assistant teachers, teachers' safety instructors, teachers' pension managers, teachers' health care providers, teachers of teachers. And we haven't even gotten to the principals, assistant principals, and superintendents. Democrats won't rest until we have achieved a national average class size of one teacher for every 0.03 students. Dodd's 2001 bill on child care is typical, with a title that sounds suspiciously as though a teacher named it, Focus on Committed and Underpaid Staff for Children's Sake Act. Dodd's bill spent about two sentences talking about children and the next 90 pages detailing copious benefits packages for public school teachers. In a sentiment born of pure class hatred, teachers are enraged that they often earn less than members of the sweaty working class, who probably don't even hold master's degrees in education theory. Consequently, the Democrats are constantly introducing bills to legislatively proclaim that all teachers are worth more than plumbers, truck drivers, and other professions whose members do not vote for Democrats. Dodd's bill couldn't even make it through the findings section without long diatribes about the indignity of bus drivers earning more than teachers. After two very brief references to the children at the beginning, the bill gets right to the heart of the matter, increasing the salaries of child care providers. Finding number three cites a growing body of research showing the value of well-compensated child care providers. Finding number four bitterly quotes Department of Labor statistics showing that in 1999, the average wage for a child care provider was $7.42 per hour, and the median wage of a family child care provider in 1999 was $264 weekly or $13,728 annually. These figures apparently include the salaries of teenage babysitters and after-school care at grandma's house. One major reason child care providers show up as being paid so little is the large number of liberal Democrat cabinet nominees who pay their nannies off the books. The average teacher's salary that year was $43,300, compared with $40,100 for other full-time workers who, I note, don't get summers off or leave work at 3 p.m. Finding number 5 expresses the class hatred of teachers toward the working class, complaining that child care providers earn less than bus drivers, $26,460, barbers, $20,970, and janitors, $18,220. Inexplicably, Derek Jeter's income from the previous year was not mentioned here. How about this? When the bus driver's failure rate of getting kids to school gets up to around 50%, which is the teacher's failure rate of teaching kids, then we can talk about equal pay for teachers and bus drivers. Finding number 6 complains about woefully inadequate health care benefits for child care professionals. Finding number 7 returns to the important matter of paying child care workers more. Finding number 8 complains, teachers leaving the profession are replaced by staff with less education and formal training in early child development. Finding number 9 complains again about teachers' low wages and limited benefits. This can't be mentioned often enough. Finding number 10 says that everyone suffers the consequences of inadequate compensation for child care providers, principally the providers, of course, but also, way down on the list, even the children. The 11th and final finding praises state programs that increase the compensation of child care providers and notes that the states could get better child care providers by offering financial incentives, including scholarships and compensation increases that range from $350 to $6,500 annually. The cost of the bill that promised to make our fourth graders as dumb as the French within 5 years was $5 billion. Every part of Dodd's Teachers Union wish list bill was calculated to produce stupid children chock full of behavioral problems. The main reason good teachers aren't paid more is bills like Dodd's. Educating children is no longer the primary purpose of the public schools. Today, their purpose is to employ 2 million people. Back in 1985, Albert Shanker, president of the American Federation of Teachers, said, "When school children start paying union dues, that's when I'll start representing the interests of school children." The public may be confused on this issue, but the teachers' unions and the Democrats are not. If you gave all the money in the United States to the public schools, they would not improve. They would simply cost more. The teachers' unions are tenaciously committed to expanding their workforce and paying every teacher the same salary, whether that teacher is world-class and deserves $200,000 a year, or is utterly incompetent and deserves to be fired, possibly imprisoned. Putting children in government schools at younger and younger ages does not help the children. It merely expands teachers' unions' membership roles. As any normal human could tell you, and studies now confirm, it's better for a child under 5 years old to be at home with his mother than in childcare, no matter how stimulating the environment. the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development studied more than 1,300 children in 10 different states for 7 years and concluded that the more time a child spends in non-parental child care, the more behavioral problems the child will have. Yes, perhaps given a choice between being left alone in a crack house as opposed to Chris Dodd's pre-K child care, the child care would win. But in most cases, that's not the choice. The Democrats' solution is to raise taxes to pay for preschool child care, which will require more mothers to work outside the home to pay the taxes, which will require them to put their children in government child care. Except welfare mothers, those are the only women in America who Democrats think should not work. The throwing money at it approach to educating children has been tried so often that teachers are now among the highest paid workers in America, with thousands of teachers, about 20,000, already earning more than $100,000 a year. Using data from the U.S. Department of Labor on household median earnings, Ohio University economics professor Richard Vedder found weekly pay for teachers in 2001 was about the same, within 10%, as for accountants, biological and life scientists, registered nurses, and editors and reporters, while teachers earn significantly more than social workers and artists. Of the seven professions Vedder compared, the only ones with higher weekly pay than teachers were lawyers and judges, which, as Vedder said, one would expect, given that the educational training to become a lawyer is longer and more demanding. Of course, only teachers get long summer vacations, professional development days, snow days, and every conceivable federal holiday. It appears that the only people who get better compensation than teachers for 9 months' work are professional baseball players. So, in order to compare apples and apples, Vedder compared hourly wages as calculated by the National Compensation Survey of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, based on the teachers' self-reports for how many hours they worked weekly. First of all, relying on self-reports of how many hours someone works is like relying on teenage boys' self-reports about how much sex they're having. 90% say they have had sex, 60% with Pamela Anderson. Nonetheless, comparing hourly wages based on the teachers' self-reports, Vedder says, teachers earned more per hour than architects, civil engineers, mechanical engineers, statisticians, biological and life scientists, atmospheric and space scientists, registered nurses, physical therapists, university-level foreign language teachers, librarians, technical writers, musicians, artists, and editors and reporters. Only lawyers, engineers, and doctors earned more. And a lawyer can't call in a substitute lawyer when he needs a personal day. Plus, it's a lot harder for doctors, lawyers, and engineers to have sex with their clients. Judging solely by the amount of time teachers spend writing letters to the editor complaining about how poorly paid they are, teachers seem to have a lot of free time. A Nexus search of all news documents during the years 2000 to 2005 that included the words letters to the editor, teachers, underpaid, and overworked produced 168 documents. The same formulation for other professions produced these results. Doctors, 60 documents. Lawyers, 30 documents. Secretaries, 30 documents. Reporters, 29 documents. Firefighters, 23 documents. Marines, 15 documents. Priests, 6 documents. Carpenters, 2 documents. Waiters, 1 document. Of course, we can't be sure that these were all letters to the editor complaining about the low pay of teachers, Marines, firefighters, and so on. They might have all been letters complaining that teachers are overworked and underpaid compared to Marines, firefighters, and others. In 2002, Bob Chase, the president of the National Education Association, NEA, complained that teachers don't make as much as engineers, $74,920, or lawyers, $82,712. But I'm thinking, why stop at engineers and lawyers? Why shouldn't kindergarten teachers earn as much as Tom Hanks and Julia Roberts? A better benchmark comparison for public school teachers might be private school teachers. Teachers in the private sector earn about 60% less than public school teachers, and their students actually learn to read. Comparing hourly earnings still does not quite compare apples and apples, or even apples and oranges, more like apples to grapes, because of the massive benefits packages public school teachers receive. Teachers have far more generous pensions than other professional workers, allowing them to retire earlier. In 1995, while the average retirement age for teachers was 59, for professional workers whose only government pension is Social Security, it was almost 64 years old. Despite this, the NEA complains about teachers' pensions being offset against their Social Security benefits. So in addition to having taxpayers foot the bill for government pensions more generous than Social Security benefits, they also want the teachers to get their full Social Security benefits. Pop quiz. If a private sector retiree has to get by on Social Security, and a retired public school teacher is entitled to two pensions, which one is hosing the American taxpayer more? Please show your work. Then there is health insurance. Many public school medical insurance plans still do not require that teachers contribute any payment whatsoever toward the premium, unheard of in the private sector, and woe to the politician who proposes increasing teachers' copay from $5 to $10. Finally, no matter what happens to the rest of the economy, teachers don't have good years and bad years. Public school teachers have absolute job security, which is also worth something. According to Vedder's analysis of the federal data, teachers receive a package of benefits worth more than 26% of their salaries, compared with benefits packages worth 17% of a salary in the private sector. All told, Vedder says, teachers' average hourly compensation plus benefits exceeds the average for all professional workers by roughly 10 to 15%. Congratulations to the teachers' unions. But do we have to keep hearing about how underpaid, overworked, and underappreciated teachers are? It's like the Islam is a religion of peace mantra, and similarly based in reality. One begins to wonder if schools of education teach anything besides how mistreated teachers are. Everyone simply asserts, as one columnist did in the Los Angeles Times, teachers are underpaid. The author went on to say that teachers give it their best and try to make it work. That must not be easy, considering they have to labor with the knowledge that someone, somewhere, earns more per hour than they do. Only an electorate educated in a school system like ours would fall for the argument that teachers aren't paid enough. Hey, maybe these teachers aren't so dumb after all. A lot of people in America have difficult jobs. There are men sleeping in their boots in Afghanistan right now, so the rest of us can sleep peacefully at night. There are store owners who haven't taken a vacation for 20 years. There are entrepreneurs working weekends and risking everything for an idea that will make the world better or safer, or on the other hand, might fail and land them in bankruptcy court. And they don't get summers off. The very fact that teachers have 3 months off in the summer and can hold other jobs is indignantly cited as further proof that teachers are underpaid. Shelley Potter, president of the San Antonio Alliance of Teachers and Support Personnel, told the San Antonio Express News, "For most teachers, it's a matter of necessity to work that extra job to make ends meet. Teachers seem not to realize that everyone else works in the summer, too." In fact, almost 80% of teachers do not take second jobs in the summer. That's according to a lachrymose op-ed in the New York Times, bemoaning the idea that teachers should spend any of their 3 month summer vacation working. "One day," the writers say, "teachers are shaping minds, a moral force in the lives of the young people they teach and know, and in some ways the architects of the future of the nation, such as by telling students Bush is like Hitler. The next day they're serving cocktails and selling plasma TVs at the mall." The indignity. If we're choosing the most underpaid profession, my pick is doctors. They spend a minimum of 7 years in school, with somewhat more rigorous schedules than those of education majors. When they finally graduate from medical school, they will leave with $100,000 to $200,000 of student loan debt. Their reward for all this hard work and deferred gratification is a residency, where they will work up to 120 hours a week, often 36 hours consecutively, for the princely starting salary of $29,000 to $37,000. Finally, the big payoff comes. But there are still the student loans to pay off and malpractice insurance premiums of $50,000 to $300,000 per year. Some doctors will clean their own office toilets when they start off just to make ends meet. According to Department of Labor statistics, the mean average salary for doctors ranges from $106,000 a year for podiatrists to $190,000 a year for surgeons, which isn't bad. Why, it's nearly as much as a school principal makes in New York City. Compare the years of training for a doctor with the educational achievements of teachers, as summarized by Frederick Hess of the American Enterprise Institute, who has a Harvard master's degree in education himself. Undergraduate education majors typically have lower SAT and ACT scores than other students, and those teachers who have the lowest scores are the most likely to remain in the profession. The lower the quality of the undergraduate institution a person attends, the more likely he or she is to wind up in the teaching profession. In a 1999 interview, Hoover Institution fellow Thomas Sowell was asked what change in America would give him the greatest satisfaction if he could snap his fingers and make it happen. He answered, "Do away with schools of education and departments of education. Close them down." "The Mickey Mouse courses that you have to take to enter the field," he said, "were driving away many of the best people from teaching." Sowell also remarked that, "The most childish letters I receive in response to my newspaper column come from teachers. They seem to think that they can simply make up their facts and that they can psychoanalyze me. They like to tell me, for instance, 'You must have had a bad experience of teachers.'" In 2001, only 60% of education students taking the basic teacher's licensing exam in Virginia were able to pass. The test asked questions like these: Martin Luther King Jr., insert the correct choice, for the poor of all races. A, spoke out passionately. B, spoke out passionate. C, did spoke out passionately. D, has spoke out passionately. E, had spoken out passionate. Anyone who could not answer that question should not be allowed to serve food in a public school, much less teach at one. But nearly half the aspiring teachers got it wrong. Acting quickly to remedy this crisis, the Virginia State Board of Education lowered the requirements, making it easier to pass while getting the above question wrong. The same thing happened in Massachusetts in 1998. 59% of candidates for teaching positions failed a basic skills test geared to eighth graders. One-third of the test takers couldn't even pass the basic skills section. In response, the state education commissioner, Frank W. Haydew III, suggested that the passing grade be lowered from 77% to 66%. When informed that one-third of applicants flunked the test, he said, "Okay, but that's still less than half, right?" Only the last sentence is a joke. Defenders of the illiterate Massachusetts teachers at fairtest.org, presumably illiterate Massachusetts teachers themselves, denounced the exam, claiming there were major substantive and administrative problems with the test. According to FairTest, the first fundamental defect with the test was that some teachers didn't grasp that their scores would count and thus were denied, I quote, "due process legal right to adequate time to prepare for a high-stakes exam." Also, according to FairTest, the company that created the test has a history of making and selling defective products. FairTest enclosed an addendum explaining to their members what the terms history and test meant. Thus, for example, FairTest says a study found that the exam was fundamentally flawed because of the lack of any demonstrable relationship between test scores and initial teacher competency. Genuine teacher competency is measured by how capable a teacher is at taking away a fourth grader's Bible and passing out condoms. In 2005, a Bronx public school teacher paid a homeless man with a history of mental illness to take the state teacher certification test in his place after the teacher had repeatedly failed the test. The test results drew suspicions because the homeless man did so well on the test. That's not a joke. Obviously, the solution is to keep paying teachers more. At least that's the conclusion the courts keep coming to, which is probably why the Constitution did not give judges the power to tax. In the mid-1980s, a federal judge in Kansas City implemented liberals' dream program to improve the public schools. The judge imposed a $2 billion tax hike on the citizens of Kansas City in order to build opulent public school campuses replete with Olympic-sized pools with an underwater viewing room, 25-acre wildlife sanctuaries, a model United Nations with simultaneous translation facilities, and, of course, higher teachers' salaries. After 20 years of the perfect experiment in liberal education theory, there was less racial integration in the schools, the purported purpose of the plan, and black test scores hadn't improved one jot. Somewhat amazingly, at one high school, the reading scores of black males were completely unchanged from freshman to senior year. Between 1982 and 2001, spending on New York City public schools increased by more than 300%, clocking in at $11,474 per pupil annually. Only Washington, D.C., that hotbed of educational achievement, spends more per student. By contrast, the average tuition for private elementary schools is less than $4,000 and around $6,000 for private secondary schools. And yet, the New York State courts officially found in 2003 that graduates of New York City's public schools are not competent to sit on a jury. The courts found that the schools were not providing children with such skills as basic literacy, calculating and verbal skills necessary to enable children to eventually function productively as civil participants capable of voting, and serving on a jury. In response, the courts ordered that yet more money be spent on the same failing public schools. It's all academic to judges who send their kids to private schools anyway. They have no contact with all the things they extol, like public education and the marvel that is the New York City subway system. Rich liberals take the subway once a year and are stunned at how big it is. Liberals are quite confident that people in Queens will be happy with their decisions. When not complaining about their low salaries, teachers say it's not the money, it's respect they want. A New Jersey public school principal complained to the New York Times that he has to leave the country to be reminded of the high regard with which the rest of the world views his occupation. According to the principal, back in America, you'll be at a party and someone will ask what you do. You'll say you're a teacher and they'll say, "That's nice," and move on. They're probably ashamed of how little they make compared with school principals. It's tough to make the case that teachers are not valued in American society. In addition to being paid more per hour than architects, civil engineers, mechanical engineers, space scientists, registered nurses, musicians, artists, and editors and reporters. According to a Harris poll taken in 2005, teachers were ranked as the third most prestigious profession, tied with firemen and just behind scientists and doctors. This placed teachers ahead of military officers, nurses, police officers, and priests. You would think there would be a little more humility in a profession where the main competition comes from nuns. Even nuns, who have taken a vow of poverty, aren't lavished with praise the way public school teachers are. When Jason Camras received his National Teacher of the Year award from President Bush in 2005, he hailed the other members of his profession for working tirelessly every day, doing wonderful and challenging work. And, he added, they do so almost always without recognition. Without recognition? Camras was in the Rose Garden of the White House, being recognized by the President of the United States of America. I'm guessing they don't teach irony at schools of education. But you know who does work tirelessly every day, doing wonderful work, and almost always without recognition? Electrolysists, plumbers, cooks, cable guys, farmers, maids, delivery men. In fact, just about everybody who's not a celebrity works tirelessly every day doing wonderful work and almost always without recognition. The president does not give out a Fireman of the Year award, Policeman of the Year award, Plumber of the Year award, Heart Surgeon of the Year award, Physical Therapist of the Year award. Apart from Hollywood actors, teachers are the most incessantly praised profession in America. Run a Google search of Teacher of the Year, and you'll get almost 40 million hits, more even than Mother of the Year. The National Football League has a Teacher of the Year award for teachers nominated by players and awards the winner a trip to a bowl game and $5,000. Walmart runs an annual Teacher of the Year contest, awarding 50 schools a $10,000 grant and the national winner's school another $25,000. The Veterans of Foreign Wars has a Teacher of the Year award, giving teachers at three different grade levels $1,000 for themselves and another $1,000 to the schools. Toyota has a Toyota Family Literacy Teacher of the Year award that awards $5,000 to the winner. The National Fire Protection Association has a Teacher of the Year award. The World Affairs Council of Washington, D.C. has a Teacher of the Year award. The California Masons have a Teacher of the Year award. The Kirksville chapter of Sigma Chi in Missouri has a Teacher of the Year award. This is in addition to all the state Teacher of the Year awards generally announced at a big ceremony with the governor. No wonder kids can't read or write. Their teachers are always jetting off to some fancy event to pick up their Teacher of the Year awards. In California, teachers get discounted mortgages and car loans and tuition reimbursement. The Department of Housing and Urban Development has a program that allows teachers to buy homes in revitalized areas at a 50% discount off the sale price. In other areas, discounts and special deals are offered to teachers by bookstores, office supply stores, computer stores, and cell phone companies. Oddly enough, public school teachers aren't offered discounts on condoms, even ones sold for use just on school grounds. They should take that up at the next NEA conference. It's all about respect, people. One teacher who managed to find time to write a letter to the editor, despite the long, long hours teachers work, to complain that her salary was very sad indeed, proposed yet more goodies that could be given to public school teachers, such as daycare for teachers only. Just don't say teachers already have plenty of benefits, or the Democrats will accuse you of hating teachers. You must weep with admiration at the mere mention of teachers. Soon, one of every five people in America will be part of the education industry, and the rest of us will work to support their salaries and benefits. In 2004, New York City investigators secretly filmed five assistant principals whiling away their days at Lord & Taylor, Macy's, Kmart, and Duane Reade. About the same time, the courts were concluding that New York public schools could not even produce a competent OJ juror, the five educators were caught on tape arriving late, leaving early, and spending the time in between shopping. They could afford it. New York City taxpayers were paying them between $65,000 and $106,000 per year to do nothing. The five assistant principals had been reassigned to administrative duties after some reshuffling in the public schools eliminated their jobs. They refused to perform any of the tasks assigned to them on the grounds that the tasks were not within the job description for assistant principal. Apparently, buying ballet tickets and shopping at Lord & Taylor were within the job description. In January 2005, New York public school teacher Frances Levine was arrested for attempted murder in connection with a brutal attack on the principal of her school. According to police, Levine's boyfriend attacked the principal, Wanda Rivera Switalski, outside her Queens home early one morning, riding up on a motorcycle and slashing her with a box cutter so many times she needed more than 100 stitches. Before the attack, Levine was overheard haranguing her boyfriend, saying, "When are you going to do it? She already has fired three of my friends. Quit procrastinating." You know a school is hurting when the teachers can't even get murder assignments completed on time. Levine's salary at the time of the attack was $57,804. In April of that year, a Brooklyn teacher earning $69,359 per year was arrested on the Lower East Side of Manhattan for possessing illegal gravity knives, which can be opened by the force of gravity alone. When the police ran his name, they discovered he had also been arrested in 1993 for disorderly conduct and in 2001 for possession of marijuana, resisting arrest, and obstruction of governmental administration. In other words, he had a criminal record so extensive, he might actually have had trouble landing a job with the New Orleans Police Department. After his earlier arrest, the teacher had simply been reassigned. In July, the superintendent of the Yonkers School District was indicted for perjury and evidence tampering for trying to cover up his appointment of a 24-year-old friend of his daughter's to a 90